Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and speak with a prominent Chinese dissident who is urging Secretary Clinton to visit Chiang Guangcheng in Beijing to ensure his safety. Bei Ling, an exiled Chinese poet and essayist and the founder of the Independent Chinese Pen Center, joins us along with Scott Savitt, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. Then we'll get an analysis of President Obama's exit strategy from Afghanistan and the extent to which it does not conform with the reality on the ground. Christine Fair, a former UN political officer who served in Afghanistan, joins us to discuss what was not said about relations with Pakistan and what will happen to the massive amounts of military materiel when the US starts its exit in 2014. Then finally, we will speak with singer-songwriter Jackson Brown about his music and politics and how he navigates between the worlds of entertainment and activism. Jackson Brown, along with a roster of great musicians, will be appearing at the KPFK Hero Awards and tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. And joining us now is Bei Ling, who's an exiled Chinese poet and essayist and the founder and executive director of the Independent Chinese Pen Center, and Scott Savitt, who is a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. His forthcoming memoir is on his two decades as an American reporter in China. Starting with you, Scott, you and Bei Ling are old friends. You're the same age, and you were both jailed and kicked out of China at the same time. Is that right?
Correct.
So give me a little bit, fill me in a little bit on what happened.
I guess you could say we're both veterans of the Tiananmen Square protests. We were in our 20s at that time, and after those events, we both started independent publications. I started the first weekly independent newspaper in China, in Beijing, and Bei Ling started a literary journal, and we were both jailed for illegal publishing.
And Bei Ling, you have written an article at CNN, Hillary Clinton Must Visit Chiang Guangcheng. Tell me about your relationship with your fellow Chinese dissident, Chiang Guangcheng.
Personally, I do not, connection with Mr. Chiang Guangcheng directly. But I'm 100% focused and follow whole situation, especially since he, in 20 months ago, in house arrest in his hometown, his house. So it's very terrible, and it's a very, very difficult situation with he and his family, and especially if in far away in countryside. The local security and the local police, they beat him, and he's in a terrible situation. So I think he's decided, leaving and some small group help him from Shandong. It's very far, I think so. It's they can drive in car around to Beijing. And I'm still think it's the American embassy letting him in and give his medical care and give his, it's a stay. That's 100%. It's this basic human rights. It's a decision.
Well, it seems there's a lot of conflicting information about the decision. The State Department, Gary Locke, the ambassador, and the Assistant Secretary of State, Kirk Campbell, seem to be saying that he didn't want to go to the United States. He didn't want to defect. He wanted to stay in China. And now we're hearing through the BBC and through CNN that Chen and wants his family out of China. What's your understanding, Bei Ling?
That's very important because he cannot get all information since he's arrived in he's in American embassy in Beijing, and he do not know his wife and his children and his relative, his brother and brother's children, the son, together, it's abused, beat, and whole family, it's things he's running out. it's kind of very, very bad. It's the beat and get hurt and all, you know, and the situation.
Sure.
After he know all things, I think that he should change his decision. He know if he's still in China, they probably do not have his two things very important. One is his freedom. This freedom, like my op-ed piece mentioned, and that freedom means he can, you know, have a basic freedom. Also, his family cannot live in, you know, it's a very scary situation. So he changed. But I still think that's a part of responsibility and they have to, you know, it's American embassy have to take. And I do not know the 6 days why he cannot get all information. Because in my part of, and I'm through a website, through media, and can get all the situation after he's running, you know, after his 6 days ago. I mean, he thinks he's leaving yesterday, he's, you know, it's out of embassy. This whole situation, very easy in Beijing embassy, they have a Chinese employee. They can open website, can read it and tell him his family, the whole situation after he's leaving. But the whole situation, just he met his wife in hospital or in going to hospital on the street, you know, it's the car. He can know all situation.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing, the spend night, that means it's yesterday's whole night and May and this whole night in hospital, and American embassy promised some people have to with him together. But leave in his room, probably whole night and nobody visiting him. Also, he call American embassy, need some urgent support. Nobody pick up phone.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel questions. I feel this is very unusual, including why he do not have any an American embassy employee or officer's private mobile phone number. He only can call embassy for general phone number.
Sure.
His situation very dangerous. It's American embassy have to have 100% responsibility after he send his out of, you know, its embassy. They need, he can anytime urgent phone call. Later, his phone cut off. That situation makes his 100%, he cannot feel he has a safe situation.
Sure. Well, let me bring, again, I'm speaking with Bei Ling, who's an exiled Chinese poet and essayist and founder and executive director of Independent Chinese Pen Center. And also we have Scott Savitt, the former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. Scott, can you give us some clarity on this confusing situation where there are very, very mixed signals? The U.S. State Department is suggesting that Chen didn't want to defect to the United States and wanted to stay in China, and some kind of agreement was made with the Beijing authorities who would somehow restrain the local authorities in Shandong province who have been persecuting Chen. And now, as Bei Ling has just said, it doesn't look like they've given him any support. They haven't shown up at the hospital when they said they would. They haven't provided him with a cell phone that could reach them directly without having to go through the embassy switchboard, etc. Can you fill us in on this, try and clarify some of this confusion?
I've just received a text message from Mr. Chen via a friend of his as we're conducting this interview. So this is the most up-to-the-moment information is Chen says, and, you know, presuming this is reliable, but I fully assume that it is. These are the people who helped him escape. And he says that it's a big misunderstanding. Basically, you know, he thanks the U.S. Embassy for all their efforts. He recognizes what a difficult situation and, how hard it was to negotiate with the Chinese side on such short notice. And, you know, what Bei Ling said about not having information while he was in the embassy, that's a legitimate question. But I think I've spent a little more time in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing than Bei Ling has. And, you know, when someone takes refuge there, number one, you can't have them have access to the Chinese employees because it's a security risk. And there are good reasons why he would have been extremely isolated under those circumstances. And he came out, he saw his wife and children, and found out that the people who had been keeping them under house arrest followed them to Beijing and threatened his wife's life. So I think if any of us put ourselves in that position, it might change your attitude. And all he said is that he has an invitation to study law at New York University, and he hopes to take up that invitation and, you know, return to China and continue his work. So that's the most up-to-date information that as far as I know.
And in Beiling's call for Secretary of State Clinton to meet with Chen and his wife and family, is that likely to happen?
Yeah, I'm 100% possible can happen.
I
really want to hear Li Ken, you know, maybe after his, you know, whole day's conference meeting and discussion with the official Chinese, you know, delegation. And he can come in any time, maybe after dinner, or he can, you know, just visiting. I think so. Until now, he's in hospital. Chinese government cannot reject Secretary Clinton, you know, visiting him. This visiting just gave a very clearly message. American government has responsibility to take care and watch and worry his situation. That's very important.
Yeah, jump in, Scott.
So the CNN op-ed that you read, basically, this was, you know, later than this time yesterday. They contacted us, so, you know, Beiling wrote it in Chinese. I translated it into English, and, you know, I had no idea what he was going to say. But when he called for Hillary Clinton, I thought, you know, it was a brilliant idea. And the U.S. holds all the cards now. I mean, they've got, you know, Hillary Clinton is very well known in China. Not only is she Secretary of State, but, you know, she's the beloved Bill Clinton's wife. And they don't dare to refuse her. So this could happen. I mean, who knows if it will happen or not, but this is how the impasse could be broken. If she exerted, and from what we know about what's gone on since he made his, you know, miraculous escape, they're calling it the Shawshank Redemption in China, you can be certain that there is frenzied negotiation going on behind the scenes even now. So everybody jumping to conclusion, I think we all need to take a deep breath and recognize that there's going to be some more unforeseen outcomes to this, and give everybody a little bit of the benefit of the doubt.
But isn't there a tremendous gulf between what we are talking about here in the Western media and what the Chinese people know about this? They've never heard of Cheng Guangcheng, have they?
A lot of people know who he is.
He's out of he's in embassy and out. Because now it's a new media in China, it's difficult, you know, they block everything. I think that still, it's, you know, they have another, you know, opportunity. They use the program, can be broke. This, you know, it's the censorship wall in internet. I think so. It's more and more people, or I should say, never had, like now, I think that have maybe 20 or 30% Chinese, you know, it's internet reader. They already know whole situation. I call all my friends in China, people, they all know the situation. Maybe do not like us, know every, you know, detail.
Mm-hmm.
But so Chen Guangcheng is already like it's the most well-known its names. In this
just a second, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, the reason that people know about him is because his work was publicized by the Chinese government. He was held up as a hero for his, you know, this blind barefoot lawyer, they call him. And, you know, he was emboldened by this. And then he stepped over the invisible line. And, you know, the real difficulty is China's having a leadership succession right now. And he was being persecuted by local officials 500 miles from Beijing. And, you know, some people think that the Communist Party leadership sitting in Beijing, they can just pull, you know, a string. And it really doesn't work that way. These locals have significant autonomy, and it's not to say that someone couldn't have reached in and protected him, and that's why this deal with the embassy, it's fairly unprecedented, but there are a lot of unprecedented things going on in China right now. So it was, you know, that's why people are so interested by this, because it's all groundbreaking. And, you know, all I can say is, I hope for an auspicious outcome for everybody involved.
Well, Beiling's just told us that about 30% of, I think he said 30% of the country has an internet use, and they're very aware of what's happening. Obviously, it's not in the media in China. It's not in the newspapers. It's not on television.
On the internet.
It's on the internet. So just to finish up with Scott, what understanding do the Chinese people have, do you think, of this diplomatic crisis, if indeed it is one?
Well, it's more than 30% saturation, by the way. I mean, China has the largest internet population with, you know, smartphones. There's more than 500 million people online. And, you know, that's a lot of people. So you have, you know, varying degrees. Some people are following it nonstop. Some people are following while they go on with their lives. But you can be certain when it's such headline news over here that a critical mass of Chinese are aware of this. And this is pure speculation. You know, this is a brave new world. It's not easy to ascertain these things. But my sense is people are paying attention, and it's going to have an influence on the outcome.
And Beiling, have you tried in any way to get a message to Secretary Clinton?
No, until now, I do not get directly, you know, information. And I really want, you know, it's through CNN website, it's, you know, American Embassy in Beijing, they can immediately send this suggestion to you know, Hillary Clinton. So because I think she only have 2 nights stay in Beijing. So that means
I bet she saw his op-ed. I met Secretary of State Clinton in Beijing, and they read the internet as well. So I think maybe one of her aides may have shown her his opinion piece.
This is the most challenging and the most important moment for her. Because this is a big damage for American, you know, human rights and foreign, you know, policy in this case happening, especially in her, you know, in Beijing moment. She has to very clearly know this is the most important things for her. She has to figure out this problem.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the general impression is so far that the American State Department has not handled this well. So even from the bureaucratic point of view, she's going to have to do something, let alone from the human rights point of view, one would think.
Pull a rabbit out of the hat. Let's see.
Okay. Well, Scott, any last word here from you? We're wrapping up now.
Yeah, I just want to make a little bit of correction, because I say it's an embassy, you know, employee, means a Chinese employee. I think so it's in Beijing embassy has to have some people speak a foreign and a reading foreign Chinese, an American citizen employee in there. They already passed a security, you know, check. They really have to every day tell Mr. Chen Guangchen new situation, you know, what's happening. Only, you know, just every day, you know, every, you know, few hours reading, you know, internet tells him, his family, what's happening or something.
Sure.
That's, you know, in our media, in Chinese media, have so many of this new information. So it's, that means he's in American Embassy in Beijing, that means have to get all information freedom. This, I do not understand.
Sure, just finish up quickly, Scott. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just in response to that, you know, Bailey and I will talk about it later, is the U.S. Embassy had a dissident in 1989. Professor Conley Drew and his wife, they stayed for a year in the embassy. What Bailey doesn't understand is when someone like this guy comes into the embassy, he is placed in a secure area. He cannot have interaction with anyone. Bailey's not understanding the security procedures that are required in that place, and that's the reason for it. And that's why people are judging what was done and not understanding the seriousness of someone entering a U.S. diplomatic compound and, you know, discussing whether to seek asylum or not. That's something that people need to educate themselves about. That's a, you know, that's a very unusual and very, especially in a communist country. So.
Right. Well, look, I think we got that cleared up, and I thank both of you for joining us here today. Bei Ling, again, the exiled Chinese poet and essayist and the founder and executive director of Independent Chinese Pen Center, and Scott Savitt, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International, and he has a forthcoming memoir on his two decades as an American reporter in China. And the article we're talking about that Bei Ling has written for CNN is available at CNN. Hillary Clinton must visit Chen Guangcheng. And let's hope she got the message. I thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Yeah.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and what they're going to be leaving behind. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. And she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And what were your impressions of the president's address recently at Bagram Air Force Base following a kind of stealth entry into Afghanistan and, of course, under criticism from the Republican nominee Mitt Romney for making too much of the anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden?
I mean, mostly the comments I thought were kind of bizarre were those about Pakistan and the nature of our relationship and what it is that we're trying to achieve and how. The comments that were made there really didn't seem to map onto reality at all. They seem to be about as fantastic as some of the statements that have been made by Pakistan's Foreign Minister Carr.
But is there anything new in that? In other words, the United States and Pakistan have been talking past each other, pretending they have a workable relationship, and arguably they've never been on the same page.
No, I mean, there's nothing new in it, but I certainly did expect from the president to have a much more straightforward discussion about the complexities in that relationship and how we're going to get things done with the U.S.-Pakistan relationship being so shambolic. I would have liked to have had a more straightforward discussion about drones, for example. I mean, how can we continue to run the drone program against such stark Pakistani domestic opposition? You know, essentially the Pakistan civilians are trying to turn back the decisions that President Musharraf made. Basically, they're saying he sold our sovereignty, but he didn't have a right to do so. And without Pakistani cooperation, you know, the accuracy of those drones go way down. Arguably, as the U.S. transitions from a heavy counterinsurgency footing to a counterterrorism footing, you know, things like the drone program are going to be an important tool. And so having better relations with Pakistan in some very minimal way is going to be key to making this reoptimized policy work. So, I mean, there's nothing surprising in that he said, but I mean, at some point, I really would like the administration to be a little bit less diplomatic and to sort of take the Americans into confidence about the real challenges that we confront as we try to get out of Afghanistan.
But Chris Fair, you work in Washington and talk to all the experts in that theater, and I would assume that there's the public reality and the private reality, that it never looks like it's worked. We spent a lot of treasure and lives on a place. There's nothing to show for it. We don't have a partner in the local government of this corrupt Karzai. Are there two narratives, the public and the private? Because it seems like the American people want the hell out of there, and it looks like Obama is actually pretty determined to get out by 2014, or at least to start getting out by 2014.
Well, I actually don't think there is this stark difference between what people say publicly and what they say privately. What I found disappointing in the talk that he gave was that, you know, essentially, if anyone who reads the New York Times, Washington Post, any McClatchy newspaper with the incredibly insightful articles written by my colleague, Jonathan Landay, anyone who essentially reads knows that the relationship is not what was being described. And so I guess I don't really understand the need for the use of an incredibly deceptive language when what we really need is someone to speak very straightforwardly about what our interests are and how we're going to secure them and over what time horizon. And so given that I do live in Washington, I do talk to different folks, I don't read, I don't see the difference between this public and private discussion.
Well, but I would have thought that in private people might say, you know, what have we gained? What has it been worth? You know,
but they're saying this publicly. I mean, that I don't think there are too many people who can say with a straight face, without being ridiculed, that we have made enormous gains in Afghanistan.
But the president said that the other night.
Well, but that's what I'm saying. What the president said the other night was really striking because it was so discordant with what the vast majority of people believe. It just wasn't a credible message. I mean, what we really want to know is, you know, what are our core interests? How do we secure those interests going forward? And of course, this does come into play with the documents that were released from the CTC from the Bin Laden compound. And Bin Laden, for example, suggests in one of the missives that they need to find a new place other than Afghanistan and Pakistan from which to stage external attacks, right? So, I mean, I'm not someone who wants to be on the perpetual al-Qaeda gravy train. By no means do I want to fall into that position of the sky is constantly falling. But we also can't be completely naive to the fact that there are elements of that organization and even other terror groups outside of that organization that do still aspire to attack Americans. And so having some minimal presence in the region is going to be important for the policy-relevant future. And, you know, Osama bin Laden may be dead, but this doesn't mean that there aren't other organizations that are capable and interested in attacking the United States. And I really didn't find President Obama's speech to really speak to, A, what we actually know about the region and the genuine questions that we have about how do we move forward and out of the region.
Well, it seems that Christine Fair, again, a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan and a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point, it would seem that the U.S.-Pakistani relationship is akin to a married couple who aren't speaking to each other. And neither has filed for a divorce. But the importance of Pakistan, of course, is significant in terms of providing the means of all the material that's shipped in there. And since that incident in which 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed, it seems that there have been very little communication. Recent talks broke down. My understanding is that there's an awful lot of supplies that aren't getting through, but the bigger question might well be that what happens in 2014 when the U.S. pulls out? Will they be leaving a bunch of stuff behind like the Russians did, or will the Pakistanis not necessarily want to cooperate on the exit?
Yeah, so I'm glad you raised that point, because the positive side of what happened in the aftermath of the Sohala strike and American intransigence to offer an apology, which for the record, I think is way overdue. We should have apologized then, and the apology that it hasn't been forthcoming is due to election issues. Everyone's worried about the endless loop of a potential Mitt Romney advertisement whereby various reports of Pakistani perfidy, and then it ends with an Obama apology, right? So there's the rationale behind the not apologizing has a lot to do with domestic politics as well as the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. But after the GLOC closure, the Americans learned an important lesson, that we can actually sustain that war in Afghanistan without Pakistani GLOCs. And the way they're doing it is that they're flying stuff in. And then they've also increased some of the stuff that's coming in through the northern distribution route. So we are supplying that. We're continuing to supply the war. It's not the case that the closure of the GLOCs has really put a lot of operational pressure. But the real issue is, as you noted, how do we get all of that stuff out? And you also, I think, correctly noted that the options are fairly straightforward, and different actors have different incentives. So we could do what the Russians did and just leave the stuff in place. And, you know, anyone who's taken a road trip around Afghanistan will see, you know, various tanks just abandoned. Some of that stuff could theoretically be made available for use by the Afghans if they could maintain the stuff. Other stuff we could simply destroy and burn in place. But you can certainly imagine that the Pakistani black markets would certainly benefit from some of that stuff there. So it's not clear that the Pakistanis have a clear incentive to get the GLOCs opened again so we can get our stuff out. Although I think you could more credibly argue that that stuff could be amenable to pilferage on its way through Pakistan than if it stays in Afghanistan. But that's the real reason why we want the GLOCs open at this point, is to try to get the stuff out of Afghanistan.
Well, just in closing, Christine Fair, what's your sense then what happens after 2014? You get the feeling that the Pakistanis are keeping their powder dry. They've never wanted the U.S. to go after the Haqqani network. They seem to be stronger than ever. They'll surely have some influence on what happens. Nobody has any confidence in the Afghan army. What is your day after scenario?
Well, I think the day after scenario does kind of hinge upon what the day after actually looks like. So I don't think too many people expect that the U.S. is really cutting and running, or even, for that matter, severing and sauntering. We're going to have some presence there. We're going to continue our training mission. We'll have some presence there in extremis so that we could actually help the Afghans if the Afghan security forces themselves fail to muster. I also don't think that the Afghan Taliban are in a position to just run back into Kabul. That being said, you know, the Afghan constitution does not lend itself terribly well to any sort of peace and reconciliation amongst the different groups in Afghanistan who ultimately have to live together peaceably. You know, we did build, and it was the U.S. and the international community that gave Afghanistan this constitution. It's highly, highly centralized. And this is where Congressman Rohrabacher got into a lot of trouble. Congressman Rohrabacher argued for greater federalism. He took it a little bit further, of course, than simply making a constitutional argument. But while I don't agree with a lot of what Congressman Rohrabacher wrote, said, and did, I do think he makes a really important point about federalism. At the end of the day, the various commanders, war criminal, pederast, jungbazi that they are under the rubric of the Northern Alliance, and the various commanders associated with the Taliban. At the end of the day, there has to be reconciliation. And that is going to require some degree of political accommodation. And that's very difficult to imagine with Afghanistan's current constitution. So in this regard, you will find many people in Afghanistan, as well as among journalists that cover it, fearing that what we're really likely to see is some sort of return to an ultimate civil war in Afghanistan.
Well, meanwhile, though, again, the president said the other day at Bagram that, you know, we're going to complete the training of the Afghan army. Well, I heard a statistic the other day that one third of U.S. and NATO casualties come from the friendlies, the people we're training who shoot us in the back. Is that right?
I haven't seen that statistic, and so I'm not in a position to evaluate it. I don't even want to speculate about the accuracy of the number. But what we do know is that there has been a very large number of Afghans killing NATO ISAF troops. We see actual Taliban infiltrating the ANSF precisely for that purpose. We see people appearing in uniforms, killing people. I mean, this has happened with an alarming frequency over the last several years. And this has actually driven some countries, I think France wanted to, wanted to escalate its timeline for getting the heck out because of these friendly fire episodes. I mean, ultimately, you know, we're in these positions of close proximity, allegedly, to be training these guys. And in addition to worrying about a Talib assault or some other kind of security incident, these soldiers who are there on a training mission have to also be worried that an Afghan is going to turn a gun on them. So, you know, this is difficult. But whatever it means to finish the training of the ANA, it's going to end in a farce in any event. I mean, the ANA, there's only so much you can do with a force that's absolutely largely illiterate. The ANA overall is more illiterate than the Afghan society from which it draws. Usually militaries are better educated than the society from which they draw because they eliminate the least qualified people. You've got corruption. The ills of this organization reflect the ills of the rest of the government, right? So the idea that we're going to finish our training of the ANA, that's kind of an absurd thing to say, because how do you actually finish the training of an organization that has a requirement for endless training?
Oh, boy. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who is a former United Nations political officer who worked in Afghanistan. She's a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Jackson Brown.
Child and man who have no idea where they will go, but they'll help you if they can. But everyone must have some thought that's gonna pull them through. I prayed for America. The dawn's early light, by all I know is right, we're gonna reap what we have sown.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jackson Brown, who has written and performed some of the most literate and moving songs in popular music and has defined a genre of songwriting charged with honesty, emotion, and personal politics. He was honored with induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004 and the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2007. His debut album came out on David Geffen's Asylum Records in 1972. And since then, he's released 13 studio albums and 3 collections of live performances. His most recent, Love is Strange, features David Lindley. Beyond his music, Brown is known for his advocacy on behalf of the environment, human rights, and arts education. He's the co-founder of the groups Musicians United for Safe Energy, NukeFree.org, and the Success Through the Arts Foundation, which provides education opportunities for students in South Los Angeles. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jackson Brown.
Thank you, Ian.
And was Gil Scott-Heron an influence on your music?
Well, I discovered him at a really, really crucial time in my music. Yeah, his song "We Almost Lost Detroit" was the song we played all the time around the time we were planning the No News concerts in 1978. And to have a black voice, you know, speaking about the danger to people in Detroit. Well, it's a danger to everybody, really. But it was very important to have a black voice speaking about nuclear power, because in general, black, it's not really on the radar. Not really on black people's radar as much as one would think, especially because of proximity to the plant and everything. So I would say, yeah, he was really important to me.
So, but he, in a way, he was the precursor of rap. I guess there was the Last Poets who came
right.
out in the 60s, but I think they
crashed. Well, he was associated with them. I think actually they did some of his material, or somehow he was associated with them. Well, they get a cover of The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
Well, but as I say, this was, what, decades before anybody heard of rap?
Yeah, that's true.
So I was talking the other day, Jackson Brown, to an organizer, another benefit that we had recently for Ralph Nader's Public Citizen, a comedy benefit, a bunch of comedians performed here in Los Angeles. And we were talking about the notion that the media has let us down as citizens to the extent that in many ways we get our news now from a comedian, Jon Stewart.
Exactly. I mean, his audience has to be pretty well informed for them to think it's funny. They have to know something about what's going on to get the irony or to get the joke. They have to be pretty informed. So there's a fairly aware audience. Presumably, they get their information from place besides the television show. Yeah, but you're right. Colbert and Jon Stewart, I mean, they're really kind of they're much more popular source of information for most people than. And certainly not network news and from the, you know, mainstream.
Well, the fact that they don't have to mediate and they can juxtapose a politician's lie on Wednesday compared to what he said on Thursday,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I was going to extend that to the notion that, you know, documentary filmmakers are making films about important issues that the mainstream media is not covering.
Right.
And I take it that the same impulse is driving you and other musicians to... you know, there's an old adage that art ends where politics begins. So it's a tough road to hoe, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been trying to slip songs past my audience, really sort of slip songs into, you know, a set full of songs about relationships or about love or about, you know, longing for one thing or another. For my whole career, but in fact, it's got increasingly easier because I think people realize that the political songs are really a part of life. And if anything, some of these songs that were in some way controversial 30 years ago, you know, have proven themselves to be, you know, of merit, and people welcome them in my set now. But I don't think that, I mean, the comparison is completely apt because I don't think you have the kind of censorship. There's the censorship of the market, for sure. You know, I mean, there are people who think, oh, there's no point in singing a song about foreign policy if nobody knows what the policy is. You'd have an easier time singing about baseball contracts or what athletes are being paid. But no, the thing is really that I think songs have to be about what people know already. You know, they already have to know something about it to consider the song good.
Well, but in many ways, for example, the song that you wrote for America, it's a very patriotic song. And one of the things that I find so extraordinary about America is the extent to which the political right has usurped and claimed patriotism. They've claimed,
yeah.
They've confiscated the Bible. They've
the
taken
flag.
The flag,
we'll
the Bible.
We'll
you know, you name it, and you know, it's refreshing to note.
Well, I was always allergic to that jingoism in the '60s, and I thought, you know, I wouldn't need to, you know, wouldn't partake of that. But really, there comes a time when you do have to express your patriotism and remind people that, you know, there was that bumper sticker, "America, love it or leave it," and the responding. Bumper sticker was "America, change it or lose it." You have to. Yeah, that, I still believe that. I think if we don't change, we really are losing this country, and not because we're going to burn it down at all, but because it's being sold out from underneath it. It's been sold to the highest bidder. Not just. I mean, at this point, you know, any foreign country can donate money to a PAC and influence our elections. You know, it's just or just the fact that they hold so much of our debt. So, yeah, no.
Well, we got, you know, the 99% movement have introduced this very helpful dichotomy of the 1% versus the 99%. But
yes,
what's particularly outrageous about this current election is that it's not the 1% that are buying the 2012 elections. It's the 0.00063%,
yes,
a handful of billionaires. It's,
yes,
I mean, it's amazing to watch.
Yeah, 20 people are going to be able to are going to spend 90% of the money in the election.
Again, I'm speaking with Jackson Brown, who is going to be appearing this Sunday, May the 6th, at a tribute, KPFK's Hero Awards and tribute, a tribute to Gil Scott-Heron.
I'm also, I'll be there to present an award to Fernando Pullum, who is an educator, a music educator, who has worked in South Central Los Angeles for 20 or 30 years. I mean, 22 years in the public schools and then in charter schools, and now he's got a community arts center, which is providing services to this community that is not provided by any of the schools, even the charter schools.
And this is this something that you've done through your foundation, Success Through the Arts?
That's right. That's right. We sort of formed to support his work when he was still in the public schools. And so we've had the experience of supporting him, you know, in the context of you know, he's been very successful all along. And so they made his high school that he taught at a music magnet. And but they still it's a very ungainly, and the supporting of the arts is the first thing to get cut. And what also happened in the LA Unified, in our experience, was that as soon as they realized that there were some fairly affluent people on the other side of town supporting the programs and adding to the programs, they actually began to cut services to those schools because they thought, oh, well, don't give it to them. They got somebody helping them already. You know, largely because there's such a paucity of funds for art. Arts are the first thing to get cut, when in fact it's the one thing that really motivates kids to show up and to do their best.
Well, I think that the fact that they're closing down libraries now, one-third of the parks and recreation budget's been cut and people have been laid off. Most of the swimming pools in Los Angeles this summer will be empty. I mean, it really starts to make you wonder about our quality of life and why it is that the public sphere is being impoverished while the private sphere, which has been rewarded. I mean, the people that crashed the economy in 2008 were rewarded by Main Street. And now, you know, they've turned their back on everybody. And we have a new form of capitalism, which is extracting wealth, not creating wealth.
I mean, I completely agree. This is the problem. And I think people are sort of held up for ransom by the idea that if we didn't bail out the banks, the economy would crash. But I don't know what they're calling this. I mean, this is a comedy. The economy has crashed around the world. And unfortunately, the Obama administration did not, you know, hold any kind of... haven't the power to make them give people loans now. They're just hanging onto their money because they don't see it as safe to take a chance with their money and give people loans. I mean, it's crazy what's happened because I think it's all about the privatization of all of our financial systems so that people are on their own. I mean, I think our country, in that regard, our country really has been sold. There is no sort of civil society that supports people. You get things because you're a citizen and because you do well and you're performing of your job adds to the whole. Everybody, it's separated out, like they've separated the casserole.
Well, and they've also made a virtue out of greed and a sin, if you will, out of altruism. I mean, the followers,
yeah,
of Ayn Rand,
the guy that's
doing the Republican budget. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to you know, I don't think American capitalism is sustainable in the long run. They've moved from producers to predators. And
well, do you think that there's a capitalism that is sustainable? I mean, is it an example of... Is this a capital that works?
Well, I think there's an example of a political system that works, that regulates capitalism, and it's known as social democracy. I mean, everybody, you know, we all make the joke that the communists are great at distributing wealth but terrible at creating wealth, and the capitalists are great at creating wealth but terrible at distributing wealth.
Yeah.
So there's obviously got to be a middle ground there somewhere.
Yeah. So do you think it's the socialist countries like the Scandinavian countries that I mean, what are the examples? I mean,
well, I think that, the social democracies. I mean, it's all of the northern European countries, Australia, New Zealand. Right next door, we have an example, Canada.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Where, and the thing that I'm astounded by is that most of our political arguments on the right are about taxes and paying too much taxes, but nobody makes the argument, wait a minute, what do we get back for our taxes? I mean...
Right. And nobody admits about talks about the war. Nobody really talks about the war as a drain on this
right. Well, that's
society's resources.
Exactly, because it's right-wing welfare.
Yeah.
Right, you know, that and agribusiness and all the rest of it. And now, you know, Obama couldn't even get the Congress to agree to stop giving subsidies to big oil at a time when they're making record profits. I mean, it's an amazing time, Jackson Brown, to think that here we are, after all that's happened to us in the last few years, a one percenter is running for president, and, you know, the guy could actually get elected.
You have to take that very seriously, I suppose. I mean, I found myself in a really vociferous argument last night. We agreed on just about everything, but I think it comes down to whether or not you really think there's... I mean, I kept saying, like, what exactly is going to be the main difference between... You know, a continued Obama administration or Mitt Romney. And my friend said, well, it's the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court has already sold this out. Maybe it is worthwhile to really fight to, you know, I mean, hope that Obama can change the balance of the Supreme Court. But, I mean, in so many ways, there's not a lot of encouragement looking at his performance in terms of the environment, in terms of secrecy in government.
Well, I suppose it's a choice between, you know, the hope that things could, you know, the certainty that things will get worse versus the hope that things might get better.
That's a good point to make. I think, you know, things can always get worse.
And really worse. I mean, one more...
Well, we have no idea how bad they can get, of course. I mean, we have it better than many places, and we're yelling about. I mean, in the United States, I mean, our... bad is, like, you know, quite a bit better than much of the world's, you know, the conditions that people live in and have always. I mean, I started to write a song about the Haitian earthquake, and it turned into a song about poverty. And ultimately, you wind up hoping for a fundamental change in the way humanity, you know, views its time in the world. But I think you have to have a certain amount of comfort to even philosophize about anything. By comfort, I don't mean comfort. I mean you have to have a certain amount of stability in your life.
Well, that's, you know, that's the tragedy with politics and probably why a lot of people in this country vote against their interests. They simply don't have the time and the energy, working two jobs, et cetera, three jobs sometimes, to really pay attention. And, you know, we know that the billionaires are going to confiscate the airwaves for the next 6 months and pour out all kinds of poison relentlessly. So... it's not a very pretty picture. Tell me about what happened, I guess it was, last September when you were visiting Zuccotti Park? Because yesterday I covered May Day demonstrations by the Occupy movement in Chicago, New York, and in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I went to Zuccotti Park during the occupation, but I didn't sing there until about a week after they sort of expelled the occupiers. I was on tour, and you know, it was a pretty hard place to sing in anyway, although it was very... very illuminating to go there, especially the people's mic and the way in which you saw people bustling around and working for this consensus. And matter of fact, that was still going on even after they shut it down. I mean, we went and sang in Zuccotti Park and sang largely to a small gaggle of occupiers and the press. And it was important to the Occupy movement that we continue to show up there and that they would continue the presence there. But in fact, they made it virtually impossible to get in there. I mean, we were able to get in by virtue of a sort of liaison with the police, and they escorted us in and escorted us out. And you know, it's very far from what it was during the occupation. But nonetheless, a few blocks away, there were offices full of people continuing to work on the general assemblies and the meetings and the various groups that are formed to communicate with each other. And I think there were three, you know, general assemblies operating in three of the boroughs. So it's kind of invigorating, really, to do it. I finished the song that I've been working on for months and months in order to sing it at that. So I sang a verse the night, and I wrote another verse the night before and sang it. And that's when it's on this Occupy, this album project that's coming out May 15th. But I think the most astounding thing is to see how it's blown up everywhere and that people understood that they could go Occupy you know, in their own town, in their own area, and that in many of these areas, I mean, that's so popular, you know, people really support what the occupiers are talking about. And if anything, it's the only criticism we ever hear is that, well, they're not as focused as you'd want, or they have to be more, you know, there has to be more of a, there has to be a list of demands and so on. I was going to write a song called The List of My Demands. That'd be fun.
Well, I would have thought Rock Me on the Water is a pretty appropriate song in a way. You know, the idea of the road is filled with homeless souls, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, every time.
And there's where the generosity is. I mean, those people who have nothing are always the ones that are the most caring and most giving, you know, the most, because they're up against it. And those people who have a lot of feel that they have a lot to lose, you know.
Right.
Well, somewhere in between the people that, and there, I think there are many, many, many Americans that are constantly doing things for the community. And those are the people that I think we can look to hope that this sort of the infrastructure, that we create an infrastructure, you know, through Occupy and through the various citizens groups. I mean, there is that view that, I think it's Paul Hawking who said that, you know, he just regarded all the events of the last 50 years and as the greatest mass movement in the history of humanity, and what's gone overlooked because it seems to be fragmented, it seems to be all individual groups. But it's a huge awakening and a huge cry to address the ills that humanity is really facing, you know, which is poverty and disease and ignorance and warfare.
Well, just in closing, Jackson Brown, again, you'll be at this Sunday, May the 6th, you'll be appearing at the second annual KPFK Hero Awards and Tribute, a musical tribute to Gil Scott-Heron, and you'll be presenting the Music Education Award.
Yes,
to
the Hero Award to Fernando Pullum.
Fernando Pullum. Just in closing, it sounds like it's going to be a fun night, right? I mean, looking forward?
Yeah, I think it's going to be amazing, and I'm not even sure who all is playing.
There'll
be a lot of music and
Jack Black's going to be there, John Densmore, Charlie Hayden, a whole bunch of people. So,
I'm excited that Jack Black will be there. I haven't seen him at a KPFK event before, but Charlie Hayden certainly, John Denver's, you know, a real stalwart, and John Trudell's going to be there. I can't wait to see what he does. I think there's going to be a presentation. I think they're presenting Pete Seeger with an award. And so it's amazing. It's a celebration of our cultural heroes and the people who are really working in the community, shed some light.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important that we see who's here and then, you know, and working for an equitable, sustainable future.
Well, Jackson Brown, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters of Just Speaking Then with Jackson Brown, who has written and performed some of the most literate and moving songs in popular music and has defined a genre of songwriting charged with honesty, emotion, and personal politics. He was honored with induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004 and the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2007. His debut album came out on David Geffen's Asylum Records in 1972, and since then he's released 13 studio albums and 3 collections of live performances. His most recent, Love is Strange, features David Lindley. Beyond his music, Brown is known for his advocacy on behalf of the environment, human rights, and arts education. He's a co-founder of the groups Musicians United for Safe Energy, NukeFree.org, and Success Through the Arts Foundation, which provides educational opportunities for students in South Los Angeles. And on this coming Sunday, May the 6th, he'll be appearing at the second annual KPFK Hero Awards and tribute, a musical tribute to Gil Scott-Heron. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.